The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Jessen, Judge Flory, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here on our second case for oral argument today, which is A20-1623 in the matter of the welfare of the child of VMS, TJRT, and DAM. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And please, each of you state the name and the party you represent at the start of your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, we are ready for you.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. My name is Scott Noakes, and I represent the appellate in this case, Ms. Brittany Schindler. This case involves a trial that was held late last year involving a transfer of custody of one child and a termination of parental rights in another child situation. And the issues here first are that the appellate feels that there's been a violation of substantive due process and procedural due process as applied to the law in this case. First, I want to focus on the issue of that underlying issue of substantive due process. It's a bit of a unclear area sometimes in the law, but basically it says that when a fundamental right, such as a termination of parental rights, is at issue, that there's a heightened level of scrutiny given to the constitutionality of a statute. Now, in this case, the statute that applies for termination or transfer of custody is not being challenged at all. That's not the issue. The issue here is that due to that heightened level of scrutiny, there has to be a compelling state interest to regulate or terminate, in this case, or transfer custody of a child to someone else. Other than
I ask, counsel, is your argument that the statutes were complied with, but even so, that creates a constitutional as applied issue? Or are you basically arguing that the statutes weren't complied with? I'm wondering why we need to reach a constitutional issue if you're arguing that there's not statutory compliance.
A very good question, Judge. Thank you. We're not challenging the constitutionality of the statutes in any way.
I understand that, but why do you go to an applied constitutional argument rather than just the statutes weren't complied with argument? Is there some, do you think the statutes were complied with, but that still presents an as applied constitutional problem?
No, the answer is no, the statutes were not complied with. In particular, the statutes that were not complied with are briefed, of course, and particularly the first issue is that there was not signatures on case plans. And, one of the requirements is that under Minnesota statute 260C.212, subdivision 1A, requires that an out-of-home placement plan be prepared within 30 days.
Mr. Noakes, if I may, though.
Yes, go ahead.
When I'm looking at that statute, which I'm doing right now, I see the words as appropriate, the plan shall be, and then kind of things like the plan shall be signed, the plan. So that as appropriate language makes it less clear that there was this absolutely must be done, which would be the impression one would get following your brief. Could you address that for me?
Well, absolutely, Judge Essen. The as applied, gives some amount of flexibility to what may be appropriate in each particular case. Not all cases maybe have the same set of underlying facts. But here, there was not just one item that wasn't signed. Ms. Mendez, the guardian ad litem, didn't sign several case plans. Her explanations that she just didn't recall why are, not compliance with the statute. The statute specifically says that the guardian ad litem, the caseworker, the parent, all of those people have to sign the case plan. And not just sign the case plan, each of those people have to actively participate in the preparation of it. Testimony was at trial that the case plan was developed by the social worker and simply reviewed with my client, and apparently the guardian of ad litem wasn't involved at all. Neither was the foster parent, which is supposed to be consulted with as well in the preparation of that plan. That goes back to my issue of why this is an issue in some ways of substantive due process, because the reason these regimented statutes are in place in the first place is to comply with that heightened level of scrutiny given to a fundamental right. So in order for you to for the court to comply with substantive due process, procedural due process in applying that statute has to be followed strictly. It's not optional. You have to follow those steps. Otherwise, you know, because the agency, Ms. Olson, suggests that, well, even still, even if there wasn't strict compliance, we get to just simply go to the issue of best interest of the children.
And, so, Mr. Noakes, if I may. So sure. The district court reading its order found that it was your client's initial refusal to disclose her location, so that the social worker, it was harder to actually work with her to create the case plan. I mean, doesn't that go to the as appropriate kind of like flexibility that the statute would provide for? Or do you disagree that that's the case? I mean, with those, if you think those findings weren't supported by the record, let us know that.
For sure, Judge. Thank you. The issue there is early on in the case, when the case first started, my client was not easy to find. She was trying to get into an inpatient treatment program. And it's true that the agency was having difficulty finding her. However, once she got into an inpatient program, they knew exactly where she was. And for a long time, many, many months, where she was. So that's not the issue there. I think the court's emphasis on that issue was misplaced. The agency knew exactly where Ms. Schindler was. They contacted her many times. But the social worker did not go there, though, and review the case plan and have Ms. Schindler participate in this preparation, which is required under the statute.
Mr. Noakes, this is all taking place during the pandemic, right?
Absolutely. You know,
and how do we factor that in into this whole, you know, what the county should be doing? I mean, I understood, like, for example, that they mailed it to her once they found, you know, the case plan that she was where she was. But as far as, I mean, you just talked about, well, they didn't go there. I mean,
yes.
how do we, if at all, factor in the difficulties of the past year when evaluating your substantive due process claim?
Well, Judge Jessen, if in fact if the situation was that the social worker was not allowed to go there due to the policy of the inpatient treatment program, that would be one thing. But that wasn't the policy. The social worker could go there. Yeah, she just chose not to go there. That's the issue. But even if she didn't go there personally, there's this thing called the telephone, Judge. And you know, we invented many years ago that allowed the social worker to call Ms. Schindler and talk to her about the case plan and say, hey, you know, I'd like to discuss this with you and have you participate in this preparation. She didn't do that. Why not, is the question. It's important that a parent participate in the preparation of their case plan so they know exactly what they need to do, and they can help tailor that plan for what they feel they need to work on for their own individual circumstance. That's why the statute says what it says. It doesn't say that a parent has the option to participate. It says they shall participate in the preparation of the case plan. It's important, Your Honor. That's why it's there in the first place, to comply with the heightened level of scrutiny that exists.
Is it your contention then that the parent did not know what was in the case plan because of not participating in the development of it?
She was later told what was in the case plan, Your Honor. Yes, she was aware of what was in the case plan, except for later in the trial, we learned that there was actually other items that were in the case plan that my client would have never told about. And on page 11 of my brief, it says that unfortunately, Ms. Johnson testified there were additional secret expectations that the agency harbored that were not contained within the four corners of the case plan, which and Ms. Johnson testified to those things. First, she wanted to see that my client had maintained at least 6 months of sobriety prior to any overnight visits, be totally honest to the agency about past chemical usage, have no contact with a person named Derek Meyer, and acknowledge that there was harm to the children and the impact of various multiple moves on the children as well. But that wasn't part of the case plan. That was just things that were not told to me, not told to the court, and not told to my client. They just came up at trial. Well, these are justifications of why we did move towards expanding parenting time beyond unsupervised visits, which were occurring, I think it started in, as I recall, in August. Oh, excuse me, July. I think I got the timeline right here. In July 13th, Brittany started having two unsupervised visits per week. So that was a period of 5-6 months that went by until trial and then order by the court of having unsupervised visits. And, you know, moving on to the issue of the Indian Child Welfare Act, the social worker unfortunately didn't know the difference between reasonable efforts and active efforts. She had two chances to explain that, but unfortunately she was unable to do it either time, other than to say, "Well, I think active efforts are more than reasonable." Well, quite frankly, Your Honors, the active efforts are defined by statute and include when ICWA applies, which it did in this case, to at least one child, that active efforts include a child home visit when appropriate. Well, under what possible rationale, if a parent's having unsupervised visits for 5 or 6 months, is there to not move forward with the next step of overnights and then a weekends and then potentially a child home visit that's required by the Indian Child Welfare Act? It's not optional. Again, it's a federal statute to address this issue of keeping Indian families together.
If I may, Mr. Noakes, if I could stop you there, because when I read this, I didn't see trial home visits as a required element, but more, I mean, active efforts absolutely are required.
Yes.
And certainly there's a difference between active and reasonable efforts. But then as far as the regs, they say, well, and they active efforts may include, right? And includes like trial home visits. Isn't that a fair reading of the federal law in this area?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. Active efforts are defined in 25 CFR section 23.2 in the definition section, Your Honor. And they specifically require, quote, taking steps to keep the siblings together whenever possible and supporting regular visits within the most natural setting possible, as well as trial home visits of the Indian child during any period of removal. You know, that's pretty specific language, Your Honor. How the agency can just ignore that is unclear, unless there's some compelling reason not to.
Right. So that for example, you wouldn't argue that there must be a trial home visit if it would be dangerous to a child.
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor. No.
So there's obviously flexibility to determine whether it's appropriate in the particular circumstances of the case. Is it not?
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. And you know, at the deck plate level here in district court, how do we know when that's appropriate? Well, the question usually is, well, are unsupervised visits going well? And the answer is yes. As a matter of fact, they were expanded from two visits a week to three. If they're being expanded, there must not be trouble with them. They must be going well. And then the next step would be overnights, then weekends, and then a trial home visit. That's just the progression of things. However, clearly the agency did not want to do that, Your Honor, and they came up with every reason they could possibly come up with to justify not taking that additional step. Nor did they curtail visits and go backwards with unsupervised visits either. That's the issue.
So, Mr. Noakes, one question I had in looking at this, and I would like Ms. Olson to address this as well, is with regard to the first child. Because it was a transfer of legal custody as opposed to the termination of human rights, do we view what constitutes active efforts, whether that's met any differently?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I believe that the issue is that because the children are siblings, that the Indian Child Welfare Act would apply to both Ms. Schindler as the non-Indian parent. And then keeping siblings together is also a stated issue in the Indian Child Welfare Act. Now, granted, they're half children, and one is a non-Indian child, but nonetheless, they are siblings. So keeping those children together, even in a regular case, setting aside the issue of the Indian Child Welfare Act, that's always a goal in every case to keep children together. And one of the ways you do that is to try to have a trial and visit and see how things go. Give that parent a chance to show if, in fact, they can parent these children together and keep them together. That's how a parent shows they can parent their children, to do it and be supervised and monitored to show that they can or cannot parent their children. That was not offered to Ms. Schindler and the children in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So you want to hit the mute button for yourself, and then we'll turn to counsel for responding.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Amy Olson. I am an assistant McLeod County attorney. I'm also the attorney that handled the entire CHIPS proceeding and the permanency trial, as is Mr. Noakes. First, I wanted to just correct a misstatement of fact about what happened with the first case plan and appellant not signing the first case plan. And Mr. Noakes indicated she was in a treatment facility at that time and it was mailed to her, and that is accurate. However, what is not accurate is that there was not a phone call. In fact, in my brief to this court and in the district court's findings, specifically on page 36 of the district court order, at the time the social worker developed that first case plan, she did call the appellant by phone and went over line by line the case plan with the appellant. And thereafter, the appellant did not sign or return the case plan. Also important to note, going back to the statute where appellant—
So Ms. Olson, if I may, coming back to that. So Mr. Noakes, and I think the statute talks about a difference, talks about participation and development of a case plan, which is different, which is arguably different than just knowing what's in it. So what's in the record that the appellant here was involved in developing the case plan as opposed to being read, told, you know, line by line what was in it over the phone?
So for the development of the first case plan, there would really be no way to have done that with her, as she was on the run and the 30 days was already gone by the 30-day time period for which the first case plan had to be developed was already expired by the time she produced herself. So that one, there really wasn't any opportunity for there to have been like a joint development of a case plan. And then thereafter, the appellant signed every single case plan. And so the only issue of the appellant not signing the case plan is that very first case plan. I did address, I'm not sure if the court has questions about the additional items not contained in the case plan, and the appellant argues therefore, I did address that in my brief. Two of those items were contained in the case plan. I'm not sure the misunderstanding about that, but the county did require in its case plans honesty about past chemical use and did require no contact with chemically dependent persons, specifically DM. The father of child two is a chemically dependent person, so that is included in the case plan.
Could you address then the 6 months of sobriety that Mr. Noakes referred to?
Yes, and also acknowledging the past harm of her children. Those would be the two items not contained in the case plan. So the 6 months of community, and it was specifically community-based sobriety, not while living in a treatment facility or a sober house. So once she's residing in the community, independent without support of treatment, then the 6 months would begin to tick. That was in response to questioning repeatedly at trial by Mr. Noakes of the social worker's opinion, when would you recommend a trial home visit? And the social worker testified, not until there has been 6 months of community-based sobriety based on the fact that there was a prior CHIPS case success, closure, and then starting a new CHIPS case following another relapse of the mother. And then in response to the harm to the children and understanding and acknowledging that, those were questions I was asking appellant during my direct examination of appellant. And she should have been able to answer those questions, and she couldn't. In fact, one of my very first questions of her during the trial was, have you neglected your kids? She said, no. So I don't understand why that has to be written in a case plan. She should be able, having gone through significant mental health therapy and chemical dependency treatment, she should be able to know and understand that she has harmed her children. Moving on to the active efforts, I vehemently disagree that ICWA requires that a trial home visit be attempted as part of active efforts. That can only be done if it's safe for the children. That was a sticking point throughout the entire CHIPS proceeding, that the county, the guardian ad litem supporting the county against the appellant, were in disagreement about whether or not to move to overnight visits and a trial home visit. And the district court always reviewed that at every review hearing, and the district court ultimately agreed with the county and the guardian ad litem that there should not be overnight visits and a trial home visit because of exactly where we're at now. The county felt that it was not safe. And then the county, in fact, proved that at a permanency trial, proving a TPR for one child and a TLC for another child. Does the court want, and this was briefed, but I'll ask, does the court want me to address the issue of active efforts any further?
Well, if I may, Ms. Olson, Mr. Noakes seemed to be arguing, and I'm sure on rebuttal he'll correct me if I'm getting this wrong, that really active efforts were required for both children because they were siblings. And ICWA requires, active efforts to keep siblings together. So I would like you to address that, as well as the question I posed to Mr. Noakes, which I think I said I wanted you to address as well, which is when we're considering what we're analyzing the sufficiency of active efforts under ICWA, does the fact that this was a transfer of legal custody as opposed to a termination of parental rights come into play?
I'll start with the transfer of legal custody, and the county concedes that active efforts still have to be met and proved for the county to achieve a transfer of legal custody. However, I still think it's definitely a factor in the active efforts analysis. So this wasn't argued yet by Mr. Noakes in his oral argument, but it certainly briefed the premise that the county didn't provide active efforts because the social worker herself did not contact the tribe. And the social worker could not define active efforts in her trial testimony. I do think that it is a factor in that analysis, the transfer of legal custody, because the entire purpose of ICWA is to prevent the breakup of the Indian family. And there was not a breakup of the Indian family for the Indian child. The Indian child was permanently placed with his Indian father. So, and appellant's parental rights were not terminated to that child. So she is still his parent. It was just a modification of custody. So ICWA itself, the entire purpose, has not been violated. And then in terms of the siblings, I don't believe there's ever been an argument made by appellant that ICWA applies to child two. However, certainly the appellant has argued that ICWA has been violated for child one because the siblings were separated. There was testimony taken at the trial that child one's Indian parent and Indian relatives would not adopt child two. Child one's father and the Indian family testified to that at trial. So unfortunately, we could not place child two for adoption in the Indian family of child one. So while ICWA absolutely wants the children and the siblings to remain together, if that can't happen, it can't happen. So there wasn't anything further the county could do about that, because we're certainly not going to remove child one from his Indian family to be placed with non-Indian family with child two. That would violate ICWA. I do want to talk about what I feel is the most concerning issue for the county in this case, and that is that the appellant is arguing that the social worker's personal failure to contact the tribe and the social worker's inability to testify as to what active efforts are should warrant a determination that active efforts were not provided for child one. And the appellant is arguing that that should be a per se or automatic analysis. And the county is arguing that it should not be a per se or automatic analysis, and that there are many protective factors. I've already talked about how the purpose of ICWA was not violated. There was not a TPR, and child one was placed with his Indian family. But there are many other protective factors. The district court found that active efforts were actually provided. The tribe itself submitted an affidavit twice to the district court saying that active efforts were provided. The appellant makes no claim she received insufficient services other than that she did not get overnight visits and a trial home visit, but she makes no claim all of the other services were insufficient. Appellant chose and arranged all of her own services. She refused county assistance in doing so. Proper ICWA notice was made immediately. The tribe intervened. ICWA was determined immediately. The tribe received notice of every single court hearing, every court filing, which would include every social worker report, guardian ad litem report, court order, case plan, evaluations. And this is particularly important. The district court personally called the tribe at the beginning of every hearing and left a voicemail for the tribe if there was no answer by the tribe. The tribe participated in some of the hearings, and the tribe submitted the required two qualified expert witness affidavits, first supporting the removal of child one and the continued out of home placement of child one, and second supporting the permanency of child one. The tribe is in complete agreement with the county in this case and was from the very get-go. The tribe is not harmed. In fact, they are requesting that child one remain with his Indian father and support the TLC. But even after all of those things, an additional important factor I think that should be considered is that appellant engaged in intentionally deceitful and abusive conduct throughout the proceeding, even during testimony. And the district court talked about that, and her own conduct should be considered. How can she argue active efforts weren't provided when she never genuinely invested in the services that were provided to her? The district court even determined that no amount of services could rehabilitate appellant if she refuses to meaningfully invest. There's no legal, going back to the case planning and the failure to obtain signatures of the guardian ad litem, foster parent, and tribe, there's no case law supporting that that would warrant a reversal. While certainly not best practices, the signatures were always obtained from appellant, but for that first case plan when she was missing. Thereafter, they were always obtained from appellant, and they were always filed, reviewed, and approved by the court. I have no further comments at this time, unless the court has any additional questions.
Very good. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So first of all, with regard to this 6 month of community-based sobriety, now in a child protection case, typically there's 6 months, which can be extended for another 6 months for the case plan to be followed, to be implemented successfully by the parent. Now, in the case where you have a parent going into an inpatient setting, sometimes that lasts several months. And then, you know, time goes on, there's, you know, number of months between review hearings. So then somehow she's supposed to demonstrate 6 months of sobriety on top of that, on top of the inpatient treatment before any overnight visits would start. That's not, the math doesn't work, Your Honor. It's simply fuzzy math and creates an expectation that is not reachable for the parent. Now, the appellant does not argue that there's a per se.
I think I have to understand that a little better. Why is it impossible to have 6 months of community sobriety for the parent?
Sure. You know, I think Ms. Schindler was in the recovery center for several months, Your Honor. You know, when unsupervised visits started in July. So then, the county is looking for 6 months of time, not in a facility. So having your own apartment, living independently, those kind of things, many times, people are getting, mothers in particular are getting, time with their children, living with them in a facility, you know, but in this case, the county's expectation is that be out of a facility, have your own place, demonstrate sobriety for a period of 6 months, and then we'll think about it.
But Mr. Noakes, didn't the trial court find that your client had a history of relapse and that while she wasn't in a facility, she was not cooperating with drug testing and hair follicle testing and things like that? Doesn't that contribute to the concern for the safety of the children in an unsupervised setting?
If that's true, Judge, and the district court felt that way, as you just expressed it, then unsupervised visits would be entirely inappropriate. Entirely inappropriate. That's not what the case was. My client had unsupervised visits twice a week, and then it was expanded to three times a week. So obviously the district court was comfortable with that level of contact with the children, despite those arguments or issues that you raised, Your Honor. At that point, if that's the court's position, then what is the remaining danger to move to the next step is the question. So in this case, at bottom, the argument here, Your Honors, is that all of these things that this Ms. Olson is talking about are go to best interest of the child for the most part. Our argument is that we don't get there unless all of the boxes have been checked for due process along the way. Social workers have to sign case plans. So do guardian ad litems. Parents have to participate in the preparation of their case plan, not just be told what they are. Those are requirements by statute. Ms. Olson wants to go to the best interest lever and say we win because we got best interest. Well, if that's only the only thing that applied, maybe she's right. But unfortunately, there's a safety pin, a safety latch in that lever, Your Honors. And that safety latch is procedural due process and substantive due process. Before you can pull that latch, you have to have all the boxes checked. You can't just gloss over things because then it's a slippery slope.
If I may. So I'm going back to this 6 month community sobriety requirement, which I was part of. Does that fit into your due process argument? I mean, I just want to understand. I mean, were you saying, look, if this was a requirement, it should have been part of the case plan, and my client should have had notice of it? Because then when the trial date came up, I would say, like, give us more time because we had this 6 month requirement. I mean, tell me how you developed that, because I am concerned that there's a requirement that was, you know, if it was that explicit, that wasn't in the case plan.
Right. I mean, that Your Honor, you said it better than I ever could. So you're absolutely right about that. It does go to the process, because my client needs to have notice of what the issues are, what the expectations are of the agency, so that I can advise her on, along the way, on what she needs to do. And if she's not doing a very good job with X, Y, or Z, I can advise her of how to do better. And we can talk about that and work through those issues. But if we don't know what the expectations of the agency are, how can we possibly talk about them? That's the issue, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Bo. Thanks for your briefing and your oral arguments. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period.